Searching the Scriptures with Watchman Alexander, Episode 11.
Is everybody in the world going to die before someone finds the answer?
Do I have to remind you that theory is the beginning of the solution?
What are we up against? Is it a dangerous thing?
All I've ever known to be true is a lie.
I didn't say it would be easy. I just said it would be the truth.
I believe this is going to be our finest hour.
Welcome to Searching the Scriptures with Watchman Alexander, where we break away from religious systems and man-made dogma to learn the Word of God from an independent Hebraic perspective. And now your host, the prophecy buff who tackles the tough stuff, Alexander Lawrence.
Hello and shalom. The hour is late, the time is short, and the storm is coming. So this is your opportunity for a systems check. I'm here to wake up the sleeping servants of Yahweh God and equip them for the last days. I do that by teaching discernment, poring over prophecies, treating the infection of Mystery Babylon in the church, and giving you courage. My book is Leviathan's Ruse, the comprehensive guide to the battle between good and evil. My website is WatchmanAlexander.com. Today's episode is going to be about cosmic signs and divine days. You know, we're just coming into the fall holy days of 2017. These are one half of the appointed times, or the modim of Yahweh, that he told his people to keep from year to year. So we're going to talk about what these mean, and especially what is their prophetic significance. What can we learn about the end of the age according to the layout and the characteristics of these fall holy days? But we're going to start out talking about the September 23rd sign. It's coming up in just a couple of days. And there has been a lot of radio chatter about this sign, or what is perceived to be a sign. And for those who aren't aware of it, this is a stellar configuration or an alignment that's happening that seems to fulfill what we see in Revelation 12. Actually, before that, I want to talk about what's happened since the eclipse. Because we had this North American total solar eclipse not long ago. It was August 21st, my birthday, in fact. And since that time, we seem to have been getting pummeled. North America is getting hit by hurricane after hurricane. We've got massive earthquakes happening. We have smaller earthquakes, but a whole string of them in a variety of places. There have been a lot of fires raging out of control on the west. There have been floods in the east and the south. We had a record-breaking solar flare that really hit our shields hard. I mean, the Earth's magnetosphere had to work really hard to keep us from being shot through with a lot of cosmic radiation. And call me crazy, but it just seems a little too coincidental that all this stuff is happening on the heels of this last total solar eclipse. The eclipse, which crossed over seven cities called Salem, it literally slashed through seven places. They were named Peace. That's what Salem means. The city of peace. That's what Jerusalem is. And the fact that it cuts across the U.S. entirely, and then 7 years from now, there will be another total solar eclipse that cuts the opposite direction and makes a big X over us. And the center of that X is right about the New Madrid Fault area. That seems like a pretty bad omen to me. Now, there's nothing in the scriptures that tells us to look for solar eclipses. There's nothing that tells us specifically when you see, you know, two eclipses trace out a path that cross each other, that's bad news. Nothing like that is in the scriptures. Nonetheless, you know, we can exercise a little bit of extrapolation here, I believe, and realize that because the word says that the heavenly bodies have been put there as signs for us, and not only timekeeping devices, but also as signs and as markers of important events, that there may be some things about these heavenly bodies that are used to get our attention, even if it's not specifically mentioned in the word. Now I can't prove it. So I'm not saying that anytime there's a solar eclipse that something bad is going to follow it. That's not it. There's solar eclipses regularly. Okay. This system that's moving around us, the cosmos, that is acting as this timekeeping device is, it's like a clock. It's going around in certain cycles. There's patterns to it. And so we're going to see eclipses happen at a regular schedule. It's normal. But what most people don't realize is that this last eclipse is part of a much bigger phenomenon, a bigger pattern that almost nobody knows about. It's a majestically symmetrical pattern of eclipses that centers around the lunar tetrad, you know, the four blood moons that we recently came through. Well, that's not the only thing that was going on. On either side of the center point of these blood moons, there are a cluster of eclipses, some partial, some total. There's a lunar triad evenly spaced from the middle of the tetrad on either side. And then there are two total solar eclipses on either side of that lunar tetrad. And then there's a few other eclipses in the middle of the, on either side of the triad. And then there's a few other eclipses within the time period of that triad. So you've got a whole cluster of eclipses that's occurring on either side of the lunar tetrads, but only, and this is what I've discovered that I don't think anybody else has discovered yet, to my knowledge. This only happens around the tetrads that fall on the Hebrew High Holy Days. So any year or any 2 years back to back, when the blood moons occur on the days of Passover and Sukkot, both years, okay, those are the, you might call them the Hebrew tetrads. There are other times when tetrads occur, but it's not always on the Hebrew holy day. It's not always on those divine days that God instituted. But the ones that do fall on those days, they seem to have this pattern of eclipses symmetrically spaced on either side. Now, I don't know what this means exactly, except that it draws incredible attention to the importance of these days. Because evidently, God has constructed this cosmic clock in such a way that it comes into alignment in a symmetrical pattern around those particular Hebrew tetrads. So to me, that's a huge indicator that we're supposed to be highly concerned with God's holy days, that we're supposed to be keeping these days and realizing the importance of them. I'd like to do more research into what has happened in the past whenever this kind of a pattern, this symmetrical eclipse pattern has occurred, and whether or not certain events of great importance to God's plan and history have occurred during those time periods. Because I suspect that that is the case, but I don't know. I haven't looked into it closely enough yet. However, I know that things ramp up as we get closer to the end. God said that the end of the age would be like a woman giving birth, that these contractions or birth pangs would happen with increasing frequency and they would get worse and worse. And so it's not surprising to me that a bad contraction might occur during this period of the greater eclipse phenomenon. And now that we're coming out of it, I mean, we're still in it, but within the next year or so, we will be exiting this latest phenomenon. And by the way, you guys need to just go look at the graphics for this, because me describing it here is not gonna really get the point across to most people. I think a lot of us need to see the diagram of it. We need to see it laid out visually. So please go to my website and take a look. There's a blog post that I did some months ago that's called, let me think, what was it? Something like, "We're Still in the Midst of the Blood Moons Phenomenon." So if you click on that blog post and scroll down to the bottom, you're going to, I mean, read the whole thing, please. It might be helpful, but at the bottom of it are a couple of graphics that show this symmetrical phenomenon. So you'll be able to see it with your own eyes and really understand what I'm saying here. I think that when God's people are not living right, that these signs are a shot off the bow. They're a warning to us to get right. But I think when we are living right, it's actually an encouraging thing. It's actually a sign that God's will is going to be done and that he's going to take care of us because he's in control of everything. You know, he set all this in motion. He put it in place. He is sovereign. He is omnipotent. So we can take solace in that fact. We can have shalom knowing that he is in control of the whole cosmos and everything that goes on inside of it. Okay, let's talk about September 23rd. I'm not going to go into depth on this because I wrote a blog post about it that you can go read and get the details, but I do want to hit on some of the highlights. So this is supposedly the fulfillment of the Revelation 12 sign. I say that's not true. The Revelation 12 sign was fulfilled in 3 BC, at the time that Christ, or Messiah, was either conceived or born. Now, I think that he was conceived at that time. I think there's other astronomical events around that time period that help us to understand that was the conception. The Star of Bethlehem happened 9 months afterward, but some people would say that that was the time of his birth. You know, it doesn't really matter to me either way, just as long as you're recognizing it. But that is when the sign that John saw in Revelation 12 actually occurred properly in the heavens. So Virgo was clothed in the sun. She had the new moon at her feet, the sliver of the moon, which was the time that the month began, was at her feet, or actually under her feet, not at it. You have to look at it as if she's laying down like a woman giving birth. And then under her is that new moon. And then the crown of stars at her head, and Jupiter at that point, the king planet, happened to be tracing out a halo around the king star, Regulus, in the constellation of Leo. So there is a cosmic sign that occurred at the time that Yeshua was coming into the world. But people are seeing this alignment happen again this month in a couple of days, and they're saying this is the fulfillment of that Revelation 12 vision that John saw. So I think that this upcoming alignment is either nothing at all, or it might be the birth of the Antichrist. Why do I say that? Well, a few things. It's close, but it's not exact. So the Day of Trumpets is when the 3 BC sign occurred. It was the Moed, or the appointed time, that God had told his people to keep by blowing trumpets, by shouting, by being jubilant. The whole day is supposed to be a day of joy. It's a day announcing something. And so what's that about? Well, to me, it was about what happened in 3 BC. It was about the coming of the king. The one that's happening this month does not fall on that day. It falls a couple days after. Now, I go by the sighting of the new moon. The sliver becoming visible is what starts the month. I think that's the biblical way of doing it. Other people do it other ways. The Jewish people have a pre-calculated calendar, and for them, the feast already started. For me, it starts tonight. Other people's calendars are going to start maybe a day or two earlier than all of that. It doesn't matter which way of doing it you use. None of it falls in sync with this sign. So the sign this month is not on the Day of Trumpets, no matter how you slice it. Close doesn't cut it when it comes to God's work, so that's a huge problem for me. Also, the that are lined up right next to Leo, that can be kind of lumped together with the stars of Leo, does not mean that the crown is being constructed by this alignment. Because they're saying that the crown of 12 stars that's worn by Virgo is the constellation of Leo plus these three planets that are lining up underneath it in a couple of days. Well, that's actually not what the 12 stars are. That's not what the crown is. The crown is a grouping of stars above Virgo that has always been there. It's always there. It doesn't move. These are not wandering stars. They're not planets. They're part of the fixed star field. and they do not shift around. In fact, if you go look at a star atlas like Norton's, you're going to find these stars pointed out and called a diadem, which means a crown. So Virgo has, now the problem that most people have in recognizing this, and I had it too initially, is that they're looking at Stellarium or a program like it, which is astronomical software that will show you all of the heavenly bodies, but it will also put drawings or illustrations of the constellations over the top of the stars and the lines. If you want it to, you can take it off, but I think by default it's there. And most of the time when people take a screenshot of this, they're taking it with that artwork on. Well, the artwork is drawn in such a way that the head of the woman is right over the top of where the circle of 12 stars are. So it makes it look like that cluster of stars is part of her head. And that's not the case. Different people connect the stars of the constellation in different ways to make the picture. But in most that I've seen, her head is not even present, or it's not clearly delineated. You just see the top of the torso, and then there's a gap, and above that, you find this circle of 12 stars. But like I said, when you see it in Stellarium, it's misleading. So the crown is always there. We don't need an alignment. And plus, you can't take the stars of Leo and make it into a crown. Not only is it just this huge thing that's almost as big as Virgo itself, you know, you're going to wear a crown that's approximately the size of your head. You're not going to wear something that's the size of a lion. And you're not going to borrow stars from a different sign and say, okay, your body is now my crown. I don't think it works that way. That's just too strange to me. So there's no reason to try and make this crown out of other things when there's already one over her and it's about the right size. Another problem is that the sun is not really clothing Virgo this time. It's more like above her shoulder or under her outstretched arm that's above her head. It's not really over her in the way that the 3 BC sun was. Now, in 3 BC, it was kind of, you might say, to the very extents of her torso, to the side of the torso, but it was still over the torso area. This time it's not. It's overhead or over the shoulder. So it's not clothing her, in my opinion. And also, we've seen alignments like this happen before several times throughout history. Now, it's not often, but remember, I said the sky works in patterns. And so the planets and the sun and the moon, they follow a path across the sky that takes them from constellation to constellation. And so even though they're moving at different rates, occasionally you're going to see them clustered up. So throughout history, there have been times when we've seen the moon at the feet of Virgo or under her feet. We've seen the sun close by her. We've seen Jupiter within her. I think Jupiter hangs out in Virgo like every 11 or 12 years. So it's not that unusual. And then we've seen the other planets at the same time be clustered up with Leo to, you know, if you wanted to make a crown. So this is just not unique. People are making a big deal out of this because they want it to mean something. And I get that. But it doesn't necessarily mean something. We've got to be honest about this. You know, we've got to be genuine and not pretending that things that are close but not exact are exact when they're not. The right things happen in God's timing. We don't need to force it. And this is definitely not the sign of the rapture, but people are so eager for the rapture to happen that they keep making these signs out to be about that when it's not. This is about a birth. It's not about a wedding, which is what the rapture is all about. The rapture is a pickup for the wedding. And this is about a woman giving birth. So no, these things are not correlated. Close doesn't cut it. So this might be nothing. Then again, it might be a mimic. And if it's a mimic of the 3 BC sign, then it may be the sign of the birth of the Antichrist. Because the first time it was about the coming of the Christ, the Messiah. The second time it's going to be about the coming of the false Messiah, if indeed that's what this is about. Because like I said, it is close. And the Messiah that will come soon, the one who will be accepted as Messiah by the Jewish people, is going to seem very much like the real thing. But he's not going to be the real thing. He's a counterfeit. And so it is quite possible that the anti-Messiah is being born this month, but I'm not going to die on that hill. Okay. This is just a theory. And if that's true, we're probably going to have to wait two or three decades to find out anyway. So don't hold. Continuing on. Oh, by the way, guys, there's not going to be any segment from Amanda today. There's no everything under the sun in this episode because we just had so much going on this week. She did not have a chance to sit down and figure out what she wanted to talk about. It's sad. I know a lot of you guys probably like hearing from her more than you do from me, but you're just going to have to wait until next time. And I just lost about half of my audience. No, I'm kidding. I know you guys like my work. All right, let's forge ahead. First of all, I want you to learn a word in Hebrew called moed. Moed means appointed time or a divine day. Moedim is the plural of that, so appointed times. There are moedim in the spring and moedim in the fall. There are seven of these moedim. It's also eight, depending on how you look at it. You can kind of combine two of them, but it's eight that also are in seven groupings, you could say. Yahweh told his people to start their calendar in the spring when the barley becomes Abib at the first moon. From there, you count forward 14 days and you reach the first Moed, which is Pesach or Passover. We all know what Passover was. That then begins a seven-day period, a week-long period called the Feast of Unleavened Bread. And during that week, there is a special day called the Day of First Fruits, or Reshit Katsir. And then 50 days after that First Fruits Day, we come to Shavuot, which is the Day of Pentecost. Those are the spring feasts. The fall feasts begin with the new moon of the seventh month, which is the Day of Trumpets, or Yom Teruah. And then 10 days later, you have the Day of Atonement, Yom Kippur. And then 5 days after that, you have the beginning of Sukkot, or the Feast of Tabernacles, which is a week-long event. And at the end of that is the last great day, which is called Shemini Atzeret. Those are the fall feasts. If you're not familiar with all of these days, you might be asking yourself, what are these about? Why did Yahweh institute these particular feast days and fast days? And what are we supposed to learn from them? Well, they're milestones. They are markers of very important events in redemptive history. They either help us prepare for something big that's going to happen, or they help us to look back and remember something big that has already happened. Now, the fall feasts have not yet come to pass, so we are still looking forward to those days. But the spring feasts have been fulfilled, which means we now memorialize them when we do the spring feasts. We're remembering what has happened. Well, what did happen? Yeshua fulfilled all the spring feasts. At the end of his ministry and then going forward a little bit from his ascension, all of those things came to pass that were predicted by these feasts. So the Moedim are prophetic foreshadows. They're telling us about what was going to happen in God's redemptive plan. Yeshua was the Passover lamb. Yeshua was the first fruits. And Yeshua was the one who poured out the Holy Spirit in fullness upon his disciples on the day of Shavuot or the day of Pentecost. All of these things were fulfilled by him. Now, I'm not going to go into depth on that right now. You can do that on your own, but it's a great study. I recommend you do it. You'll see God's glory in a new way. What we're concerned about right now, though, is the fall Moedim. And here's what's important to realize. If Yeshua fulfilled all the spring Moedim in order, you know, with the correct spacing and the days falling in the right places, I mean, the way that the Jewish people and before them, the whole 12 tribes of Israel had been celebrating these things is exactly the way in which it was eventually fulfilled. The timing was set in place beforehand, and it happened just that way at the end of Yeshua's ministry. If that's the case, then we should come to the conclusion that at his second coming, he will fulfill the fall Moedim in exactly that same way. That the timing, the intervals between the days, it's all going to be exactly like that in the very end of the age when Yeshua comes back. So let's talk about the fall Moedim and be sure that we understand the timing of these days. The fall feasts begin in the seventh month on the first day, which is the Day of Trumpets, or Yom Teruah. Really, it's not just trumpets, it's shouting, it's making a loud noise, it's any kind of proclamation. That's what this day is all about. The day itself is supposed to be sweet. It's supposed to be hopeful. I'm going to get around in a minute to why it may not be that way in the end. But in the past, before Christ anyway, it was meant to be a day of proclamation of something good. It was supposed to be about celebrating something awesome that's going to happen. I don't think it's going to be that way in the end. In any case, this day marks the beginning of a 10-day period called the Days of Awe. Now, the Days of Awe is not a term you're going to find in the scripture. This is something that the Jewish people do by tradition. It's their culture, but it's not necessarily biblically prescribed. However, not everything, you know, not every scripture has survived. Not everything is in the Bible, because there are books that the Bible talks about as having been inspired by God that just didn't get included. They didn't make it down through the ages. So it's quite possible that the Days of Awe was talked about by God to the prophets at some point, and we just don't have record of that anymore. But it's not a bad thing. It's certainly a very good tradition to have, to be reflective and to repent and get yourself ready for Yom Kippur. So I fully support this whole Days of Awe thing, even though you don't find that phrase in the Bible. After the Days of Awe, on the 10th day of the 7th month, is Yom Kippur, or the Day of Atonement. It's actually a Day of Atonements, plural, but you'll hear it usually said the Day of Atonement. During the years when the tabernacle or the Holy Temple was standing in Israel, the Aaronic high priest would enter into the Holy of Holies on this Day of Atonement. And this was instructed in Leviticus 16. And on that day, he would stand before the Ark of the Covenant in the most holy place and sprinkle the blood of the sacrificial goat on the atonement cover of the Ark of the Testimony. And by doing so, he would make atonement for the whole community of Israel. Of course, Yeshua's blood is the only blood that makes final and eternal atonement for us, because only a human life can substitute for another human life. But the ceremony is a demonstration of his work being applied equally after the cross and before the cross. These people did not know how God was going to accomplish the mission of mercy, but they believed that he would do something, that somehow he would be able to have mercy on his people. And so they did what God had told them to do, even though they didn't fully understand it. And Messiah's blood was retroactively applied to them. The reason that it was a goat that was slaughtered and not a lamb is that Messiah became a goat when he went up into that cross for us. He was a lamb, but the goat is the rebellious one. The lamb is usually not rebellious. And I'm talking, you know, with physical flocks here, with normal earthly flocks of goats and lambs. It's usually the goats that are the rebels. And so Yeshua took on that identity for us when he went to the cross. He became sinful. He became a rebel against God for our sake. And that's what was killed. That's what the wrath came against. You know, the Jews rejected him. They rejected their Messiah that they had been waiting so long for. And they've been blinded to that fact for 2,000 years, for the most part. There's a small number who have come to Messiah, but it's very small. But when Messiah appears in the sky at the end of the age, the Jews are going to understand what they've been doing all these years. They're going to finally get it. Why have we been sacrificing the goat on the Day of Atonement? Why did the high priest put his hand on the head of the goat and transfer the sins of the people to it before killing it? They're going to understand the symbolism and how Yeshua was the fulfillment. Wow, what a day. 5 days after Yom Kippur is Sukkot, the 7-day Feast of Tabernacles. You'll find this in Leviticus 23 and Deuteronomy 16. Sukkot runs from the 15th to the 21st of the 7th month. Yahweh instructed the Israelites to observe the Feast of Tabernacles by building booths, or tabernacles, and living in them for a week so that they would remember how they dwelt when they came out of Egypt, and how he dwelt with them. So God lived in a tabernacle among them, and they had all of their individual tents or tabernacles. And they remembered by doing this that they were slaves at one time. And when we do it now, we remember the same thing. Not that we were slaves in Egypt, because we personally weren't. Of course, neither were most of the Israelites throughout history. But we remember beyond that, that we are slaves to sin, and we are slaves in a system that is against God, that is set against God. We are slaves to the evil one until he rescues us and brings us out of that spiritual Egypt. The week of Sukkot is a party. I mean, this is a time of singing, dancing, imbibing, enjoying fellowship to the utmost. This is supposed to be the most joyous time of the year, and it's called the season of our joy. You're going to understand as we keep talking why it's called that. And then at the end of Sukkot is the last great day. It's the eighth day after Sukkot starts. And technically, it's its own thing. It's not really part of Sukkot, but it gets lumped in. And this day is also a Shabbat and a time of gathering where all the people are expected to be together and to celebrate with utmost joy. So those are the fall Moedim, but the question is, what does all that mean? Well, let's start at the beginning with Yom Teruah, the Day of Trumpets. Most people who research eschatology assume that this is about the rapture or the resurrection. They think this is the day when that trumpet is going to blow that the Apostle Paul talked about. You know, he said at the last trumpet is when we would be, in the blink of an eye, caught up to be with the Lord, that we would be translated from our normal bodies or our dead bodies, whatever state those happen to be in, even if we're just dust, you know, even if we're decayed to particles and there is no more body, a new body will be given. The dead will rise first, and then those who are still alive will rise right after them, and everyone will be gathered together to the Lord to be with him forever. So they say, this is the day of trumpets, and the last trumpet is when the resurrection occurs. Therefore, that's what the day must stand for. I actually disagree with that. And I understand why people say it. I mean, it makes plenty of sense. But we're forgetting something. The trumpets on the Day of Trumpets are not the last ones. There's another one. And there's a passage in 2 Kings that I'm going to take you to that's going to support this. It's going to help explain this a little bit. But let me explain why the Day of Trumpets it's not the completion of all of the blowing of the trumpets. Because every 50 years, there's a year called a Jubilee. The word Jubilee means trumpet. And on that particular year, everything is released. It's supposed to be a return back to how things were in the beginning. It is the year of the great restoration. And on that year, or just before it actually is when the proclamation begins, on the seventh month, on the 10th day of the month, you have another trumpet blown. This one is called the loud trumpet. And here's the instruction in Leviticus 25:9. Yahweh says, "Then you shall sound the loud trumpet on the 10th day of the seventh month. On the Day of Atonement, you shall sound the trumpet throughout your land." That trumpet, I believe, is the one that Paul was speaking about. Not the trumpets on the Day of Trumpets, but that one loud trumpet blast on the Day of Atonement, but only on the Jubilee. That just makes sense, doesn't it? But let's go to 2 Kings and look at a passage that's going to support this. We find Isaiah, the prophet Isaiah, talking to King Hezekiah because an army from Assyria has come down and is going to invade Jerusalem. They are surrounding the city and they're going to besiege them. And Hezekiah is, of course, very concerned about this and brings the prophet in to hopefully give him a good word. And the prophet does give him a good word. And he says this in chapter 19, verse 29. And we're going to go to verse 31. "And this shall be the sign for you. This year, eat what grows of itself, and in the second year, what springs of the same. Then in the third year, sow and reap and plant vineyards and eat their fruit. And the surviving remnant of the house of Judah shall again take root downward and bear fruit upward. For out of Jerusalem shall go a remnant, and out of Zion a band of survivors. The zeal of Yahweh will do this." okay, I know that seems like totally esoteric to most of you guys, but let me break it down. This scenario was a foreshadowing of the end time siege of Jerusalem by the armies of the Antichrist. Isaiah, elsewhere in his book, in his oracles, calls this character the Assyrian. Now, if you've followed my work at all, you know that I point out that throughout the Tanakh, the Antichrist is called by the name Asher. The word Asher or Asher is exactly the same word that's translated Assyrians or the Assyrian throughout the Old Testament. So the only way that you can know whether or not you're talking about a person called Asher or a people called by the name Asher is context. Sometimes it's talking about the nation of Assyria. Sometimes it's just talking about the man Assyria or Asher. And every king of the Assyrians was considered to have the spirit of this god king that founded their nation, and his name was Asher or Asher. So this is a prophetic foreshadow. The Assyrians coming down to sack Jerusalem, yeah, that's going to happen again. In Hezekiah's time, the angel of Yahweh went out and decimated the Assyrian encampment. Well, on the day of the Lord yet to come, Yeshua, now the angel of the Lord, I believe, and most scholars would agree, is a Christophany. It's an appearance of the pre-incarnate Yeshua. Okay, so this angel was actually Yeshua before he came to be a human being, going out to fight against the Assyrians. Now, fast forward to the day of the Lord at the end of the age. Yeshua himself will come back, and he's going to fight for Jerusalem against Asher, right there in that same valley around Jerusalem. And he's going to decimate the host of Antichrist. The armies will be slaughtered, and then you'll have the feast where all the birds are invited in because the amount of bodies is just uncountable. Well, Isaiah says to Hezekiah that the sign of this prophecy is related to the gathering of crops. So the people of Judah were not to farm their land for two consecutive years, but they could do so on the third year. This is very instructive to us. This is a big hint, because the only times when farming was not allowed in Israel for 2 years in a row was at the time of the Jubilee. Because the 49th year of the Jubilee cycle was a Shabbat, and then the first year of the next cycle, which was the Jubilee year, was also a Shabbat. So for 2 years in a row, they could not farm the land. That's why this sign is so instructive to us in knowing when the resurrection will be. It's because it's telling us that the Jubilee is the sign of when Jerusalem will be protected by Yeshua, when it will be redeemed from its state of oppression under Asher or under the Antichrist. This is telling us, guys, that the end of the age is a Jubilee year. And on the Jubilee year is when that trumpet is sounded on the Day of Atonement. So if there's a resurrection or a rapture that coincides with the last trumpet, it's going to be on the Day of Atonement on a Jubilee year. Now, we don't know when the Jubilee years are anymore. We've lost count. So do not go believing that the Jews know, because their years are off. So don't go thinking that they know when the Jubilee is. It's not going to help you to set a date for when the rapture is, okay? I'm not encouraging that. But I think as we get towards the very end, and we know when the the 70th Shemitah of Daniel is going to occur, the 70th week of Daniel. We know when that's going to start. It's going to start when the two witnesses show up and begin their ministry. So from that point, we know there's 7 years. That's going to tell us it's the last Shemitah of a Jubilee cycle. So as we get closer, we're going to know basically when the resurrection will occur. But only those of us who are paying attention, who really have searched the scriptures for this. Other people, I'd say the vast majority of people, even those who are dedicated Christians, are not going to understand this. They are not looking out carefully enough. You know, the apostles told the disciples that they were ministering to that they would not be surprised by the coming of the Lord, because they're looking for it. They know what they're looking for. Okay, they're aware of these things, but the rest of the people would not be able to ascertain when he's coming back, they would be in the dark. So for them, it would be like a thief coming in the night, but it would not be like a thief in the night to those who were preparing and who were training their minds to understand the season that they're in. And that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to understand when this is going to happen, because this is our blessed hope. This is what we're looking forward to, that time of the resurrection. And we're preparing our souls for it. We're making ourselves spotless so that we will be ready to be picked up at that time. Remember, only half of the virgins were wise virgins. Only in the parable, only half of them had oil in their lamps. The other half got left behind. They did not get picked up and taken into the wedding chamber. So if you want to be one of those people, make sure that you're getting your soul right and that you know what season you're in. Of course, the question is going to arise, if the resurrection is on the Day of Atonement, then what's the Day of Trumpets about? And the truth is, I'm not sure. I have a guess, but I can't say for certain. So help me out here. If you have any revelations about this, I would love to hear them. But what I think it might be about is the invasion of Jerusalem. So there's a lot of scriptures that have to do with what's going to happen with the people in Israel, especially the Jewish people who have not accepted Messiah in the last days leading up to the end of the age. And I really can't teach on all of that right now, but let me try and condense some of it down and give you a basic picture of what's going to be happening. So halfway through Daniel's 70th week, which is going to be 3.5 years before the end of the age, this is what kicks off the Great Tribulation. The 3.5 year Great Tribulation is when the Antichrist finally shows his stripes and he sets himself up in the temple as God. He's going to stop the daily sacrifice, and he's going to create an abomination in the temple. And he's going to sit there in the holy place proclaiming himself to be God. Now, a lot of the Jewish people are going to go along with this because they, with the rest of the world, will be deceived into thinking that this is the Messiah. But there are going to be some Jewish people who realize, and the book of Daniel says this at the end of the book, it says, those who know their God will not be deceived. So there are going to be some who understand that Yahweh's laws, his instructions, don't change. He doesn't ever change what was already instituted. And Yeshua affirmed this. He said, until heaven and earth passes away, not one jot or tittle will pass from the law. God's instructions will not change, and they will not be done away with until the end of everything, when heaven and earth are remade. That hasn't happened yet. So there are going to be people who understand that this guy who they thought was the Messiah has to be a false prophet, because they are told in the Torah to reject, we are told that we should reject any prophet who changes the laws that were already given, who goes against what was already established by God. That person is a liar. Do not follow them. Do not pay attention to them. This is why it's so hard, guys, to get Jewish people to accept Jesus as their Messiah, because they know that Jesus did away with the law according to Christian ideology. They have to reject a person like that. They are instructed in the Torah to actually kill people that try and do that. So that's the veil that's over their eyes right now, because the Christian world has said, oh, you know, all of that stuff from before is all done away with. And they're saying, wait a minute. No, it's not. It's forever. The Torah says it's eternal until everything passes away. This law is going to stand. So we're not going to believe in that. When they come to the understanding that Yeshua did not do away with the law, he did not take away a jot or a tittle from the Torah, and heaven and earth has not passed away, so it is still in effect, then they can be open to the fact that Yeshua was the Messiah. But there are going to be some Jews who apply this same test to the anti-Messiah, to the false one. They're going to say, wait a minute, this guy just defiled the temple. This guy just tried to change the set times, because Daniel says that the man of perdition or the man of lawlessness, is going to change times and seasons. So he's going to do away with God's Moedim. He's going to institute his own things. And there are Jews who are going to say, foul. This is not okay. And they're going to turn on him. When that happens, they are going to get hunted, just like the rest of the Christians. So the book of Revelation tells us clearly that Satan is going to go after those who hold to the testimony of Yeshua, but he's also going to go after all those people who will not bow the knee to the Antichrist. I need to keep this in order. So the Antichrist will set himself up in the temple temporarily, but he is then going to leave. He's going to go to wage war on the parts of the world that have not yet been conquered by the New World Order or by the end time Babel kingdom. Daniel talks all about the war between the king of the north and the king of the south, and the support that comes from other places for the king of the south to help repel the king of the north, who's the Antichrist. And so there's this big campaign going on. There's a lot of warfare. And even though the beast kingdom has taken over a large portion of the world, it doesn't take over everything. There are people in other nations outside of this empire that are trying to resist it. And so he's going to go off to war, which he's been conducting campaigns for a long time. And his stop in Jerusalem is just temporary. So he's continuing that. And during that time, a lot of the Jewish people who resist Antichrist are either going to be killed or going to be taken as slaves. And this, I'm drawing this from a number of different oracles in the Tanakh, the Old Testament, that say that the Jewish people will be enslaved and taken to battle again. And that some of them are going to resist. In fact, there's an oracle that says that God will raise up for the Jews seven principal men or seven shepherds who are going to go to war against Asher. And they're going to take the war even to the gates of Nimrod. So they're going to go into Shinar and back over to the Mesopotamian region to war against Asher. I think probably because Asher is going to set up his cities and his military bases back in Mesopotamia, where he originally was, where the Assyrian Empire got started, and where Nimrod was, by the way, because Asher went north from southern Mesopotamia and started the cities of northern Mesopotamia. So it all goes back to where it originally started, and God's going to raise some people up in the Jewish nation who are going to fight, and it's probably going to be mostly guerrilla warfare because of the power of this beast empire. But they're going to resist. A lot of them will be killed, but they'll have some success. And the Antichrist is going to come back to deal with this eventually. And at some point, he's going to put his fist down. You know, he's going to lower the hammer. And that's when he's going to invade the promised land with all his forces. And he's going to besiege Jerusalem. In fact, it doesn't even sound like it's going to be a siege, really. It sounds like more of just a steamroller, much like what happened in 70 AD when the Roman Empire came through. It's kind of a repeat of that. In fact, the fall of the Second Temple under the Romans is really a foreshadow of the final fall of Jerusalem at the hands of Asher. Wow, some kid is blowing a trumpet outside. Not very well, but he's blowing a trumpet. I wonder if he knows that it's the Day of Trumpets or if he's just practicing, because it's like a regular trumpet. It's not a horn. It's not a shofar. That's so funny. I don't know if you could hear that in the recording, but yeah, somebody just started blowing out there. Where were we? So the Antichrist oppresses and enslaves the Jewish people for a while, for 3.5 years. And they fight back. But then at the end, he finally comes in with all the forces and attacks Jerusalem. And there are a number of Old Testament prophecies that speak about this day of attack and of blowing the trumpets and warning Zion and shouting to alert the people that, hey, this is the day of battle. This is the time to go to arms. I think that the Day of Trumpets at the end of the age on that Jubilee year, or right before the Jubilee year, is that day when the Antichrist rolls into Jerusalem. I think it's that day when they have to rouse everyone to fight, because because they realize, you know, this is it. The forces of the beast are coming against us. And if we don't hold them off here, we're done for. I said a few seconds ago that he comes in with all the forces. That's not really what I meant. I mean, he comes in with his armies that he's been using in his campaign, but he hasn't yet drawn the kings of the East. He hasn't yet brought in all of the armies from all of the kingdoms involved in the Beast Empire. Because remember, there's 10 kings, there's 10 regions in the Beast Empire initially. And each of these regions has an army, some smaller, some large. That's why some are clay and some are iron, because not all of them are equally strong. But the Antichrist will have a fighting force that's made up from people from these different regions, but he won't have every man of fighting age. He won't have every soldier that exists with him on a regular basis. That's what happens at the very end, after the sign of the Son of Man has appeared and everyone has realized, oh, you know, Yeshua is coming back and we've got to do something to try and stop this. That's when everybody is drafted to come make up this enormous army that's going to attack Jerusalem, because they know that that's Yeshua's place. So I suspect that some of Antichrist's military is going to besiege Jerusalem, and it's going to start on the Day of Trumpets, but they're going to hold it off for a while. They're going to fight this thing, and 10 days are going to go by, and then on Yom Kippur is when the sign of the Son of Man will show up in heaven. It's when Yeshua is going to come to get his bride, and then the siege will stop, because we're told everyone will run to the mountains and the clefts in the rock and into the holes of the ground, and they're going to hide from the Son of Man, and they're going to mourn and weep because of the wrath that's coming upon them. They're going to say the day of his wrath has come, and who can withstand it? So it's going to be an awesome day for the bride. We're getting picked up. But for everybody else, it's a day of terror, great terror. And at this point, they're not going to be worried about attacking Jerusalem. They're going to all run and hide, scatter like cockroaches. And then while the wedding ceremony is happening in heaven, the 7 days of Sukkot, which is that wedding ceremony, then, man, I want to go into this more, but I'm running out of time. I got to talk about the Hebrew wedding and, you know, the ancient customs and how this all works in. But just shortly, yes, the wedding is that 7-day honeymoon in the chuppah that's been built onto the Father's house in heaven. That's where the bride will be for a week. And then there's a wedding feast after that. Only at the end of that stuff can Yeshua then come back. And really the second coming happens, where he goes all the way down and touches the earth with the armies of heaven, and he starts to go to battle. During the intervening time between the first siege of Jerusalem and the return of Christ, what happens is the people come out of hiding after the sun comes back and the sign of the Son of Man disappears, and, you know, he's gone for the time being. I think that they start coming out of their holes and they say, what do we do? And that's when the Antichrist puts in effect his final solution. Hey, we're going to fight this. We're going to not let this false god come down and take over this world. It's our world. We're going to fight it. So he drafts everyone in the world who can fight. The kings of the East come. Everybody from the different realms of the beast kingdom are drafted. They all come down and they meet at Megiddo, the Valley of Megiddo. And then they start to go south from there, and they just raise through the promised land until they get to Jehoshaphat, the valley around Jerusalem. And that is where the armies of the Antichrist will be slaughtered, because Yeshua will return to Jerusalem. There will be a great earthquake such as has never happened before. The mountains are going to melt and fall apart. Every island's going to crumble. Every wall is going to crumble. This is the big climax, okay? So the armies of the Antichrist are going to, they're going to think that they're going to completely roll over Jerusalem and destroy everything on that last day. But instead, what happens is Yeshua intervenes. He protects Jerusalem, and the Antichrist's forces are completely decimated. So the first siege was a limited siege on the Day of Trumpets. The last siege does not get carried out the way that they expect it to. It's going to be stopped in process by Yeshua. There's a lot more I want to talk about, and I want to take us to some specific verses in the Old Testament especially that talk about the stars falling from the sky and all that stuff, and how that's different from the final second coming with the armies of heaven. I want to get into all that stuff, but I'm out of time, so we're going to have to do that on another show. Wow, an hour passes by really quickly, doesn't it? Okay, guys, if you have any questions for me, you can send them to questions@watchmanalexander.com, and I will try to answer those in a future episode. If you've liked this podcast, please rate it on iTunes. It really helps. You can also find it on Google Play, on Stitcher, and a few other places. Maybe even Blog Talk Radio. I think that they are approving the show as we speak. So you can find it in those different places. And if you have the ability to rate it in any of those platforms, I ask you to do so. It will help me to be found. So that wraps up today's episode. Until next time, be wise as serpents and harmless as doves. Watchmen out.